So we've been watching this show on Amazon Prime lately. It's called I Shouldn't Be Alive. It's basically about people who find themselves in situations where they should have died. They shouldn't be alive. You know, some people get shipwrecked on a desert island, or they get lost in the Amazon rainforest, but they've got a broken leg and a fractured back. And it documents these real-life scenarios, these real-life stories of people and the challenges and the opposition they had to face and overcome in order to survive. It's pretty neat. If you have Amazon, you should check it out. Could you imagine being called to a task with all sorts of obstacles and opposition that you'd have to overcome? Imagine that the task that God called you to was illegal, that by doing the task that God had given you, you could end up in jail or even dead. And then you got to figure out all of the logistics. You need, you know, planes or boats, people to help you to carry out this task, all without drawing attention to yourself so that you don't get caught. Well, have you ever heard of the name William Tyndale before? He's the guy that brought us the first English Bible. Tyndale was English, of course, and he was in England. And there, in the 1500s, there were no English Bibles. It had been translated into Latin at that time. So you've got English speaking, and the people that could read would read in English, but the scriptures are only in Latin. So it's sort of locked away. It's almost like a secret. You can't have access if you don't speak or read Latin. The priests knew it. They could read Latin, and they could speak it. But again, that's not helpful. If the priest is speaking Latin and you don't know what they're saying, you have no idea what's going on. In fact, here's a random magic nerd fun fact for you. The priests would be conducting the church services in Latin, and at times they would turn their back to the congregation in order to offer up prayers or to do communion. And so when the priests would say, "This is my body," in Latin, which I don't know, I'm going to butcher this, is something like "Hoc e corpus meum." And for the people that don't know what the priests are doing and don't know what they're saying, it sounds like hocus pocus. And they're doing something magical up there. So that's where you get that magical phrase, hocus pocus. Anyways, I digress. Tyndale wanted to translate the scriptures into English, but that was illegal. If it was going to happen, he was going to have to find a way to overcome the odds and the opposition. I'm sure many of you heard of William Tyndale, but try this name on for size. How about Humphrey Monmouth? Is that familiar to anybody watching or listening? It might sound like one of the Puppet Club names, but it's not. Humphrey was a businessman who met with Tyndale. He was able to get protection for Tyndale, and he financed his work, including the translation of the Bible. He provided his own merchant ships, as he was a businessman, so that the translated Bible could be smuggled out from where it was and distributed to the people. So when we hold up our English Bibles, it was Tyndale who had the spiritual burden for the task, but it was only through Monmouth's generosity that the task could be completed. Today, as we continue our series on Nehemiah, we turn our attention to chapter 5. The first portion of the text is going to pick up on the theme of overcoming opposition that we saw last week. So we're going to spend a little bit of time there, and we're going to add some grout to that fourth building brick. I'm not sure if it's grout or mortar, but grout sounds a whole lot better. And then we're going to focus as we shift our focus as we look at Nehemiah and how he was able to overcome that opposition. And there it will establish our fifth building brick, generosity. So we have a rather lengthy portion of text to cover today. And so my hope is that you have read Nehemiah chapter 5 beforehand. The beauty of technology is that if you haven't, you can just simply pause right here, go read chapter 5, and then come back and join us. Now, rather than reading it all together at once, we're going to cover it little chunks at a time. So we're going to begin with the first 5 verses, we'll read it, we'll talk about it, and then we'll move on to the next chunk. Now, the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their fellow Jews. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." Others were saying, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine." Still others were saying, "We've had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are the same flesh and blood as our fellow Jews, and though our children are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless, because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." So here in these verses, we have an issue outlined for us. And I think it's pretty easy to pick up on the fact that there is poverty going on. Poverty on a massive scale. The poverty is the result of really two causes. First, Judah's commercial ties with their surrounding areas in their neighborhoods, they're likely severed or at least strained at this time because of the different hostilities at the time. That normal flow of commercial trade had dried up. Okay, second, the project of rebuilding the wall was taking some serious sacrifice. It was requiring a lot of sacrifice from the people, putting a lot of extra demands on the people. As we read last week earlier in chapter 4, while half the people were working on the wall, the other half had to defend the weaker areas. And so when you're defending, you're putting more strain on the people because you can't be producing food. Poverty is a real serious issue. The people are struggling to eat. This is not just a little problem. This is very serious. This is not a little famine. This is significant. We know how dire the situation is because the wives joined in on the complaint. That is unusual. See, at that time, and we can see it through the book of Nehemiah, women stayed in the background. So for the text to go out of the way to tell us that the women or the wives joined in the complaint gives us an idea about how serious, how severe this situation was. Now, their poverty is an issue, but it actually leads to much larger problems. We can follow the breakdown in the text. So the people had big families, a lot of people to feed, but with all of the extra work and the added strain of building the wall, they're not able to produce enough food. So because you can't produce it, you have to buy it. But you're poor to begin with, so that makes buying anything pretty difficult. So, to be able to do that, they had to mortgage their properties or borrow money. Now, if you've mortgaged your property, you still have to pay the royal tax on it, but you've got no money to pay it, so now you have to borrow more money in order to pay that tax. And as I mentioned, commercial trade had dried up, so where are the people turning to borrow this money, to mortgage your properties? They're going to their fellow Jews. They're mortgaging their properties and borrowing money from their fellow Jews. The few wealthy within the community are profiting immensely off the backs of the poor. But then look, what's the result? Their children are taken into slavery. Exodus 21 spells out some of the details of debt slavery. And basically, the children are taken to work for the creditor until the debt was paid off. But of course, that creates more problems, doesn't it? I mean, you're poor to begin with. You need all of the help that you can get to work and to scrape together what you have, but now your help, your children, have to go work for somebody else for free. As for their daughters, it says they've already been enslaved or submitted. This is referring to the fact that the daughters were being taken by the creditors as a second wife. They are completely powerless. But this is not a foreign nation that has come to do this to them. It's their own Jewish brothers. Poverty is not so simple, is it? It wasn't for the people of Nehemiah's time, and it's not so simple today. There's been a picture making the rounds on social media lately. It's of a homeless man. He's looking pretty shabby, and he's sitting on the curb. He's got all these bags of stuff around him, and he's holding up a cardboard sign. He's asking for help, and it says that he's willing to work. And just a few feet from where this guy is sitting, there's an employee from a big box store, looking all middle management type, and he's holding a sign with a dumb smirk on his face saying that they're hiring. Because it's just that simple, right? You're going to take this homeless guy off the street as he is and put him to work in your store as what? A customer greeter? The guy likely has no address, probably no bank account, most likely no identification. Everything he owns in this world are in the bag sitting on the curb around him, and who knows what other struggles he might be dealing with. Poverty isn't so simple. It's a symptom of a much larger societal problem. We'll see how it plays out here in the text. Let's look now to verses 6 to 8. When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, "You are charging your own people interest." So I called together a large meeting to deal with them, and I said, "As far as possible, we have bought back our fellow Jews who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your own people only for them to be sold back to us." They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. So Nehemiah, he hears the complaints and he is warm. He's angry. He immediately recognizes the severity of this situation. Pastor John spoke last week on overcoming opposition. This is internal opposition. This is all happening within their own team, their own bubble. This is not opposition. These are not problems being created from a foreign nation or from an outside influence. These are problems and obstacles created internally. Now, Nehemiah recognizes that the entire economic infrastructure was in danger of collapse. That's a pretty significant problem. The poverty of the few people is going to grow and grow and grow until it erodes the entire economic infrastructure. But why is he so angry? Again, it's because it was the wealthy Jews that were profiting off of the misery of their brothers. That was a thought that enraged Nehemiah, because he knew that ultimately such selfish, inconsiderate, and blinded behavior risked the entire idea of having a peaceful Jewish community. It put that entire idea in jeopardy. This is important detail in verse 7. Yes, he's angry. The situation is wrong, but he doesn't jump right into action right away. He ponders things in his mind first. He knows he needs to take action, but he doesn't allow his anger at the situation to thrust him into immediate action and maybe make the wrong decision or the wrong move. He pauses, he ponders things over in his mind. Don't do anything when you're exhausted or really ticked off. You gotta stop and assess the situation first, and that's what Nehemiah does here. But it's a delicate situation though, isn't it? If he doesn't act with enough strength, the problem won't be resolved. But the problem directly involves a lot of his top guys, the wealthy and the noble people that are around him. So he has to contemplate these things carefully. Then he brings the charges against the nobles and the officials. And again, what is of great concern to Nehemiah is that debt slavery. He says, as far as possible, we have bought them back. And now the debt's going on again, but it's happening internally. And what the great South African theologian Charles Fensham says, who once referred to me as Harry Potter, by the way, though there isn't a specific action described in the book of Nehemiah, what Nehemiah is describing is that at some point there was a concerted effort by the Jewish community to redeem or to buy back their fellow Jews who had been in debt slavery to foreigners. But now they're being sold back into slavery to their own people. Doesn't make sense. Fensham again points out that Nehemiah is emphasizing the Jews are being sold. Sometimes people try to cutesy up what slavery was in the Old Testament, but these people are being sold. It's wrong. And Nehemiah levies this accusation against them. And at the end of verse 8, we see that they have no response to the accusation, so he continues, verses 9 to 13. So I continued, what you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain. But let us stop charging interest. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the interest you are charging them. 1% on the money, grain, new wine, and olive oil. We will give it back, they said, and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say. Then I summoned the priests and the nobles and the officials to take an oath to do what they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, in this way, may God shake out of their house and possessions anyone who does not keep this promise. So may such a person be shaken out and emptied. At this, the whole assembly said, Amen, and praise the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. So, in dealing with this internal obstacle and overcoming this internal opposition, Nehemiah had listened to the complaints, he listened to the issues, he pondered it, he carefully considered it. Then he's gone to the noble folks, the wealthy, and with the accusation. He's given them an opportunity to tell their side of the story, but they are doing exactly what they've been accused of doing. But now, just before we get to the resolution of this issue, we get a little bit of a bombshell. Nehemiah himself and his men have been lending people money and grain as well. I think this takes some real guts to admit to that in this situation, but he's lumping himself in with all of the others. Now, this is important, though. There's nothing mentioned about Nehemiah being involved in debt slavery. Okay, later in the chapter, we'll read that Nehemiah didn't even own any land, neither did any of his men. So coupled with that and the anger that he has about this, yes, Nehemiah had made some loans, but he's not involved in debt slavery. But by even confessing just a tiny bit that he was involved, Nehemiah can now say, let us. He's not just pointing the finger and telling them, you got to do this. He can say, we need to do this. Let us cancel the loans and give everything back. And to put the exclamation mark on it, Nehemiah summons an assembly of priests and makes the nobles and officials take an oath that they'll do what they promised And the oath comes with a warning and a little bit of a demonstration as he shakes out his robe. If you don't do what you said, God's going to shake you and your house, and you'll be completely emptied. And with that, they keep their promise and the issue, that internal opposition, had been dealt with. Good job, Nehemiah. Now, we get to sort of the postscript to the issue. And it's here in this postscript, in the next few verses, we really see why Nehemiah felt the need to take strong action and what made him effective in overcoming and resolving this internal opposition. It's in these next few verses we really establish our fifth building brick. So let's go ahead and read now verses 14 to 19. Moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, until his 32nd year, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. But the earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them, in addition to food and wine. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. Instead, I devoted myself to the work of this wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, as well as those who came to us from surrounding nations. Each day, one ox, six choice sheep, and some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. In spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor, because the demands were heavy on these people. Remember me with favor, my God, for all I have done for these people. Nehemiah gives us a very clear example through his life and through his leadership. The example shows us that Nehemiah had a generosity that was rooted in a clear head and clear eyes. Nehemiah's position of governor allotted him all sorts of privileges. He was entitled to charge the people a tax for himself, on top of all of the other royal taxes they would need to pay. And then the people directly underneath and surrounding Nehemiah, they would have actually been able to charge a little bit of a tax of their own, sort of a processing fee kind of thing. That's what the previous governors had done. They had put a heavy burden on the people so that they themselves could enjoy a lavish lifestyle. And they had allowed their immediate people to lord it over everybody else as well. Though he could have been entitled to it, Nehemiah refuses. He simply does not want to burden the people with a heavy task, with a heavy tax, or to have any, you know, pesky minions running around. He and his men were devoted to the work of rebuilding the wall, so much so that they didn't even bother to acquire land. Nehemiah could have allowed his position of prominence, the entitlements that come with it, to fill his head. He could have taken so much from the people just for himself, in order to allow himself to have a real cushy lifestyle. But he has a clear head. He has reverence, fear, and respect for God. So he simply would not and could not act like that. His generosity was rooted in a clear head, but also clear eyes. Eyes that could see and watch out for others. He didn't want to put unnecessary burden on the people with additional taxes. He didn't want to take that allotment of food and other things because that would be too much pressure, too much burden on the people. In fact, he opened up his table to 150 people to enjoy and eat. Now, if he's not taking the allotments and he's not charging a tax, how's this stuff being paid for, you might ask? Well, either he's paying for it out of his own pocket or it's coming out of the budget that he has as governor. Either way, the people are not paying for this. So he's got a clear head. It's not filled with his own illusions of self-importance. Instead, his head is filled with reverence for God. That reverence is what dictates how he acted and how he led. But he also has clear eyes. He's looking out for people. He's others-focused. I don't need to explain to you how we can find examples all over the world of corrupt and lazy politicians who do nothing but profit off of the backs of others. That's what Nehemiah's predecessors were like, but Nehemiah wasn't like this. Where other people, like the governors before him, would be looking to cash in and just take as much as they could from the people for their own gain, Nehemiah is focused on the people themselves, and he's focused on the task at hand. When he first came in, land prices would have been dirt cheap. If he wanted to, he could have snatched up as much land as he wanted. And then, as the prices rose, as the wall was rebuilt, as the infrastructure was developed, he could have cashed out big time. Of course, the people wouldn't see any of that money. But he doesn't do that. He doesn't even acquire any land, and neither do any of his men, because he had clear eyes and was others-focused. Nehemiah was a generous leader. His reverence for God dictated how he acted and how he led. He was generous. He was concerned for his people. He didn't want to add to their burden. He was a generous leader. Because he had a clear head and clear eyes, he was generous. And it's because of that he was able to swiftly and competently resolve the internal opposition that we saw earlier. Now, had Nehemiah not had reverence for God, not had a clear head, if he had not looked out for others or had clear eyes, he could have cashed in on the plight of the people. At the very least, he could have certainly just turned a blind eye to it and not cared. The results ultimately would have been catastrophic. Entire economic collapse and perhaps the peaceful idea of a Jewish community right down the drain. But he's got clear head and clear eyes. It's his generosity is what puts him in a position to overcome that opposition. Just like without Monmouth's generosity, Tyndale couldn't complete his task. Without being rooted in generosity with a clear head and clear eyes, Nehemiah would not be able to overcome that opposition. You might be thinking, okay, Josh, you keep saying that Nehemiah is generous over and over again. We get it. Well, generosity is a significant building brick. To be generous is to have a readiness to give. It's so significant, that word give, that it shows up 2,152 times throughout Scripture. The word pray, that's a pretty significant word, you would think, right? How many times do you think it shows up? 371 times. What about the word love? That's got to show up, probably the most, you would think, right? Wrong. 714 times. The word give shows up more than pray and love combined. So it must be pretty significant. Generosity is ultimately about being unselfish. What's the most famous Bible verse, John 3:16, say? God so loved the world that God what? Gave his one and only son. Generosity is love in action. And our God is a generous God who values generosity. I want us to turn to the New Testament. Just take a little snippet from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 6:19-24. It says this, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." Jesus is saying here, don't be selfish. Don't store up, don't pursue those earthly treasures. They don't last. Live for me, store up what really matters in heaven. And Jesus says here, if your eyes are healthy, then your whole body will be full of light. So, how's your vision? What are your eyes seeking out? Do you have clear eyes like Nehemiah did? Do you have eyes that see and look out for others? In baseball, what do they say? Keep your eye on the ball? I mean, that's what you're trying to hit, so you got to keep your eye on it. Have you seen the movie Aladdin? I know Abby and Victoria watching probably have. Well, Aladdin gets dropped into the Cave of Wonders. He's surrounded by treasure and jewels, but he can touch nothing but the lamp. So he keeps his eyes on the lamp. In Matthew 14, when Peter gets out of the boat and is walking on water, he has his eyes fixed where? On Jesus. But as soon as he gets distracted with the wind and the waves, he takes his eyes off Jesus and he sinks. We need to have clear eyes. Our mandate is to love God and love others. Our eyes are our window to the soul, or as Jesus says here, the lamp to the body. What we fix our eyes on is what we'll pursue. We need to have clear eyes like Nehemiah, eyes that see and care for others. Then Jesus says this, you can't have two masters. Just like Nehemiah couldn't have it both ways. He couldn't fill his head with his self-importance and pursue what he thought he was entitled to and have reverence and respect for God. Either God was going to be number one or Nehemiah was going to be number one. It's the same for us. Either God and God's ways and agenda are the decision maker in your life, or you and your agenda is the ultimate decision maker in your life. You can't have it both ways. Our God is a generous God, and generosity is love in action. If we are to take hold of this building brick of generosity, then we need to have a clear head and clear eyes. Now, I know I'm preaching to the choir here when it comes to talking about this building brick of generosity. Collectively, as a community, Byron Community Church is very, very generous. And again, I know this has been mentioned a couple of times during this pandemic, but it's worth mentioning again. You've stepped up. You've been very, very generous. Now, neither I nor Pastor John know, nor would we want them, the details of who gives what, but I know that as a community, our obligations are being met. Our bills are being paid, and that's because of your generosity. Our community here, as many of you know, we have a designated fund called Helping Hurting Families. That's to help hurting families. And again, it's because of your generosity that we were able to distribute some of those funds to help some families at Thanksgiving. We look forward to being able to do something similar at Christmas. But though it may be a strength of our community, we can still brush up on it. And as our time winds down, there's basically two things I want to emphasize about generosity. Generosity is about more than money. You can be generous with your time, using your time to serve others, whether that's assisting with a church activity or just giving your time to others, making phone calls to people who may not get to interact with a lot of people right now, or helping your neighbor rake up their leaves or soon shovel their driveway. You can be generous with your encouragement. Generosity can take on many, many forms. The other thing that I want us to recognize is something that I mentioned at our Thanksgiving service. Everything we have comes from God. Everything we have ultimately belongs to God. I think we have this habit of looking at our income, for example. We bring in this much and we say, okay, this is mine, and then I'll set this aside, this little portion for God, but the whole thing belongs to God. It's all God's. But when you are generous and you give some of it away, it's your love in action. You're being faithful. Again, we can talk about money, but we can talk about all sorts of things. The time that you've been blessed with each day belongs to God. The skills you have, it comes from God. It belongs from God. God has blessed you with these things. God wants you to be faithful with what he's given to you. God is generous to provide us time with our families, a job where we get a paycheck, different passions and skills. God wants you to be faithful with what he's given to you. Be generous with it. Put your love into action. Now, as we conclude our time together, as has become my custom, I want to leave you with a couple of homework questions, some things to think about. You may want to journal them. All right, we've got three questions today. First, how is your vision? You will pursue what you fix your eyes on. So what things are you fixing your eyes on these days? All right, our second question. Nehemiah was involved in loaning money too. When he was faced with the complaints and the issue, he recognizes the plight of the people and that his actions were contributing to their difficulty. We didn't talk about this, so spend a little time thinking about what this says about Nehemiah's leadership and about his character. I see at least two significant things. See what you see. And finally, notice here, Nehemiah did not actually solve the problem of poverty. He alleviated the suffering of the poor, and he stopped the wealthy from taking advantage of them. Though we may not be able to immediately solve the problems of the world, what are some tangible ways that you might, and collectively as a community, we might be able to alleviate some of the suffering of others? How can we put our love into action and through our generosity spread the light and love of Christ? May we recognize that we have a loving and generous God. May we take hold of this building brick and ground ourselves with a clear head and clear eyes. May in our generosity, we imitate our generous God and put our love into action to bring God honor and glory.